This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The military continues its crackdown in Myanmar. Two demonstrators were killed this weekend, but that's not turning off the protests.
People are not afraid anymore. People feel like they don't have anything to lose anymore, but just get on the street.
Also today, the U.S. rejoins the U.N.'s Human Rights Council. The Biden White House plans to hold even American allies accountable for abuses. Some say the U.S. first needs to look in the mirror.
There's no human rights, let's say, culture and infrastructure in the United States.
And Israel is not saying much about its worst ecological disaster ever, but the oil spill speaks for itself.
In some beaches, there were a lot of dead animals who were covered completely with tar. Lizards and sea turtles and seagulls.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is good to be with you this last Monday of February. We begin the show today in Myanmar, where a tense standoff between the military and a popular uprising has taken a deadly turn. This weekend, security forces fired on peaceful protesters, killing two people. Ever since Myanmar's military ousted elected officials on February 1st and seized control, demonstrators have been flooding the streets of major cities. Today, more rallies and the general strike continued, with hundreds of thousands of marchers refusing to go to work. Organizers say Monday's turnout may have been the biggest so far.
Just get on the street and resist. That's the only option we have.
That's Tinza Shunle Yi, one of Myanmar's most prominent protesters. She was one of many people defying the military by demonstrating today.
We see millions out there on street, not just in the big city like in Yangon, but across the whole country as well. In 14 years, I think this is the biggest turnout. People are so passionate about democracy and human rights, and also to restore the power of the ruling party, especially releasing the leaders right now. And people are so disappointed at the military and their action against the peaceful protester on the recent day as well, because there were fatal shootings against the peaceful protester and the arrest at night to different people. We have nearly 700 political prisoners right now.
Well, there were people killed over the weekend in protests in Myanmar. So were you facing police today? Was the crowd at all frightened?
The police, they were intimidating the protester by extending the internet ban. Before, the internet ban is every day from 1 a.m. to 9 a.m. But yesterday, they extended to 12 p.m. So we were so worried what would happen, why the internet blackout, you know. And as well, there are kind of rumors out there, like military are coming in, they are transforming their track into police track. So all these rumors out there. But on the day, we all get on and we see each other, you know. People are not afraid anymore. People feel like they don't have anything to lose anymore, but just get on the street. And this is the biggest kind of a defense of the democracy in the country.
So that was today. At night, the military and police are going after activists in their homes. What risks do you and other organizers now face after dark?
So after dark, there is a curfew, and it's from around 8 p.m. to around 4 a.m. every day. So after 8, people are not on street anymore. And then the police just mingling around, and they are roaming, they are guarding also the military as well. So just yesterday, they were shooting a volunteer guardman. So these people got killed. So after dark, anything can happen to us. The arrest, the killing, anything could happen to any of us. So we are living with that uncertainty. We don't know what will happen tomorrow when we are out on street, even tonight, right?
So let's talk strategy. You say you have nothing to lose, Tinza. Are you trying to maintain a nonviolent position?
Yes, because we learned lessons throughout our history. In 1988 and 2007, there were a lot of violence. People keep their own nonviolent resistance, but just the military, they are the most violent, you know, arms group in the country. And they will do anything they can in the past uprising as well. So we're not sure about their side. But for us as civilians, our biggest weapon is the nonviolence, it's the nonviolent resistance. The strongest and the most threatening attack to the military is civil disobedience movement.
So you are facing a military that does not back down easily. What can you actually accomplish in the streets?
So we're not sure about the end result yet. Nobody can tell that, right? But we are benefiting from the whole process that we become united more than ever, not in the history. You know, we all become one against the military. So there is no gender, no religion, no ethnicity, even no color as well. So we all are united against only one enemy, which is military. And another one is, you know, with all these Rohingya crisis going on in the past few years, people are being overwhelmed with these propaganda by the military. Now people are seeing this reality, and now they are confessing to the general public that they regret they couldn't stand for the Rohingya people. They didn't stand up for the minorities, you know, oppressed minority by the military. Now they regret and they say we're going to be standing for each other in the future.
I'm speaking with Tinza Shunle Yi, a well-known protest organizer in Yangon who's been out on the streets of Myanmar's largest city today. Let me just clarify something, Tinza. Are you saying that this coup has turned Myanmar's people against the military's aggression against Rohingya in a way that had not happened before the coup?
Yes, exactly. Not just Rohingya, but also other ethnic minorities. They are fighting the same army since the very beginning. And military, you know, make a kind of propaganda against these minority and people mistake them. Now we are realizing ourselves, reflecting the struggle that we have gone through with these military propagandas. And now they are confessing, they are admitting. It's a good step for all of us to have an equal and peaceful future. So for the Rohingya people, they're not alone anymore.
So you've got these internet blockages imposed by the military. How exactly are you organizing some of the biggest protests you've seen in your life in Myanmar? I mean, is it heavy reliance on virtual personal networks, VPNs, or word of mouth now?
You know, we just got our devices in 2010, 12, you know, so we are used to that dark age. We know how to communicate. We know how to spread out the messages. Of course, with the help of social media, it was a lot quicker. So there is the internet blackout, but they ban the internet at night. And so on the daytime, we can stay communicate and we can use it. Now we are migrating, not just on one social media, Facebook, we are migrating to Twitter, to other accounts. Also, we are using different secure messaging apps so that we will not be tracked. So these are many different changes within 20 days, yeah.
Where do you look for inspiration, Tinza? I mean, from the Arab uprisings 10 years ago to Hong Kong, more recently we've seen mass protest movements put down by government forces. What have you learned from these efforts? And how do you think your movement could succeed where other movements have failed, are failing?
These uprisings happening in my region, happening in the world, like Black Lives Matter, for example. Obviously, in this information age, you know, we learned, we read news and not just Black Lives Matter, but also with the Fridays for Future, you know, for climate change, etc. So All these things obviously show us a way that, you know, we have to resist. Even in the first world countries, they still have to protest. And why not in the third world country like us? We feel like we are all in this together. You know, the dictatorship, the coup culture, for example.
Coup culture.
Yes. It happened in my country, but that happened in the region as well. We learned from Hong Kong. Hong Kong made mistakes. What are the lessons learned, right? What about in Thailand? What can we learn from them? I think they are also learning from us too. This is how we pursue our humanity as a race. Yeah.
I'm curious to know specifically, what have you and Myanmar protesters learned from Black Lives Matter?
Black Lives Matter really awakened all of us, you know, to identify what are the root causes of the racism even in the U.S., many people go on streets and protest against these deep-rooted racism. And so even in the U.S., it happened that way. And Obama was the president. Even that situation, the racism is there. So that clearly shocked us. That clearly awakened all of us in the country. So obviously, in this uprising, we address racism, we address discrimination. So that's a clear message that inspired from Black Lives Matter and also from other protests and uprising against racism.
Tinza Shunle Yi is a well-known protest organizer in Yangon, Myanmar's largest city. I've been hearing your phone buzzing away with people trying to reach you during conversation. I know you're in the center of the action, Tinza, and very busy. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Across the globe, there is a single international organization entrusted with the promotion and protection of human rights. That's the United Nations Human Rights Council. Today, it's holding its first regular session since President Biden took office. The White House is rejoining the council in an observer role. As the world's Rupa Shenoy reports, there's a lot at stake right now, and action is needed urgently.
The UN Secretary General says COVID-19 has caused a pandemic of human rights abuses. Situations in Myanmar, Venezuela, Syria, South Sudan, and Sri Lanka are on the Human Rights Council's docket. Egypt is also a central concern, as more than 100 NGOs call on the Human Rights Council, or HRC, to establish a way to monitor and report human rights violations there. David Kay is a law professor at the University of California at Irvine. He says the biggest challenge the HRC may face is itself.
The biggest challenge is just its credibility on the international scene.
Because it hasn't held its own members accountable for human rights violations, Kay says. That was one of the Trump administration's criticisms when it withdrew U.S. participation in 2018. Kay says the U.S. left a vacuum that allowed China to increase its influence.
China is committing some of the most serious human rights abuses in the world. While they're doing that, they are also seeking to play a pretty active role on the council itself.
To address that, Kay says the U.S. needs to support actions that hold even its friends accountable, from Saudi Arabia and Egypt to Poland, Hungary, and Israel. And he says the U.S. needs to account for its own human rights abuses, something it's not prepared to do.
Historically, the United States has simply not implemented its human rights obligations in the United States. There's no human rights, let's say, culture and infrastructure in the United States.
That was highlighted last year when Minnesota police killed George Floyd and anti-racism protests spread across the U.S. and the world. African countries asked the council to establish an independent commission of inquiry to investigate police brutality in the U.S. The U.S. successfully lobbied to widen the scope to focus on all countries and just make it a report from the High Commissioner for Human Rights. An update on that report is due next month, and many groups will be closely watching how the U.S. reacts, says Salma Hosseini of the International Service for Human Rights.
We look forward to seeing the United States constructively engage in good faith with this process, with the report, and with genuine self-reflection and commitment towards change.
That will be one of the early tests of the U.S.'s renewed commitment to the Human Rights Council, Hosseini says. Meanwhile, there are people paying a cost for a lack of progress at the HRC. The human rights workers on the ground who report to the council. Shamini Darshni Kalimuthu works with some of them as executive director of the Asian Forum for Human Rights and Development in Bangkok.
Without their participation, it would be impossible for diplomats sitting in Geneva or New York to make an informed decision about what is happening, say, for example, in Myanmar or Sri Lanka.
But human rights workers face increasing reprisals. They're receiving death threats and being jailed by their home countries or having their passports confiscated.
Many defenders are constantly under state surveillance. Some have been labeled as terrorists. They face trumped-up criminal charges under draconian terrorism and other laws. Many are in detention.
Kalimuthu says atrocities in some parts of the world are going unaddressed because it's too dangerous for human rights workers to report back. But she doesn't think countries committing violations should just be kicked off the council.
Even if states are complicit to attacks and reprisals against human rights defenders, we think that they should still have a seat at the table because it's peer pressure, right?
Peer pressure. It may be the only way to restore the Human Rights Council's credibility and use it to peacefully address the many dire human rights situations around the globe. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Oil on the Mediterranean beaches of Israel and ships churning across the Arctic Ocean midwinter. We head out on changing seas just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Israel is suffering from one of its worst ecological disasters in memory. Since last week, an oil spill has been washing up along Israel's entire Mediterranean coastline. In a video posted on Saturday by a ranger from the Rosh HaNikra Nature Reserve, that's Israel's largest beach sanctuary, the rocky shoreline is tinted black.
Why did you put? We'll get some.
What a tragedy, the ranger murmurs. I want to cry. All of Israel's Mediterranean beaches are closed until further notice. Officials believe the cleanup could take years. Joining me now from Tel Aviv is Yara Peretz. She's a climate justice activist at GreenCourse. So it took Israeli officials a few days to determine how big this disaster actually is. Can you describe the extent of the damage?
The extent of the damage is still something that is being looked into. Unfortunately, no one is really able to say how bad the damage is to our beaches. And also, there is still oil inside the Mediterranean Sea. We do know that for over 160 kilometers of our beaches have been contaminated by tar. It's just awful. You know, I was there on Saturday cleaning the beach together with my friends and a lot of caring citizens who saw the horrible pictures and were just devastated. And all we wanted to do was to get there as fast as we can to get this tar out of our beaches.
What do we know so far about the cause of the spill?
Just now, actually, the Ministry of Environmental Protection banned the publication of the identification of the ship.
A gag order.
Yeah, that's what they did. The ship that the oil spill came from. And this is obviously very upsetting for us because, like, why? Why do you have to gag order it? The public that is affected by this, we deserve to know who's in charge of this. And those people should be held accountable. The people who are on the ground right now taking care of the dirty work are environmental groups and citizens that care about this issue and not the government. And the government is busy with putting gag orders on things.
Well, Yara, let's get back to what this looks like. You said you went out and volunteered to help clean up the beaches over the weekend. What did you see?
Well, you see tar everywhere. It's in these small, tiny pieces of microplastic, and it's in big chunks throughout the beach. In some beaches, there were a lot of dead animals who were covered completely with tar, like lizards and sea turtles and seagulls. You know, when you pick up the tar, you actually smell oil. And the people who organized the beach cleanups really asked us to come for only 2 hours and not more because it's dangerous to be exposed to this material for so long.
Yeah, I was going to say this is toxic sludge, a fin whale that washed up on shore dead, and some of the tar was discovered in its digestive system, although we don't know if that is the cause of death. But I'm wondering if the oil or being near it had any side effects on you.
Well, for the whole day after that, I felt my throat very burned. It was unpleasant to breathe, but it wasn't. I didn't feel bad or anything.
Finally, Yara, we've heard how these beaches along Israel's Mediterranean coast are just tinted black with oil. The beach you volunteered at, can you describe what it's like on a normal happy day when there isn't an oil spill?
Yeah, so in my opinion, it's the most beautiful beach in Tel Aviv-Yafo area. It's in the south of Yafo. It's mostly quiet. There are a lot of families, both Jewish and Palestinian families, just hang out there. It's very clean, and now it's just polluted. During COVID, and still we're in COVID, but during lockdowns, one of the best things to do was to go to the nature and to just breathe for a second, right? Because you're stuck at home all the time. And the nature that we have in Tel Aviv is the beach. And now you can't even go there.
It does sound lovely when it's a normal day. I do hope things get cleaned up real soon. Yara Peretz is a climate justice activist at Green Course in Israel. Thank you very much, Yara. Good luck.
Thank you.
From oil washing up on beaches in Israel to oil tankers in Arctic waters finding shortcuts to markets, usually this time of year, thick ice prevents ships from passing through parts of the Arctic Ocean. But this month, this year, history was made, and not in a good way. For the first time, a tanker sailed through Russia's northern sea route in the month of February, a trade route connecting northern Europe to China. Yet another piece of evidence that climate change is altering the Arctic forever. Joining me now is Victoria Herman, who leads the Arctic Institute, a Washington-based think tank. What exactly does this mean, Victoria? A ship passing through the northern sea route in the dead of winter. Is this a surprising development?
Unfortunately, it's not a surprising development. We know that the Arctic is going through an unprecedented transition. It is warming at almost 3 times the rate of the global average. That means that we are experiencing warmer sea and air temperatures and a whole lot less ice.
So the Arctic sailing season used to be June to October, the summer months, Northern Hemisphere. That's when the ice is melted enough for ships to pass. Are you saying, Victoria, that the season is effectively now 12 months a year?
The season is becoming a 12-month season. That doesn't mean that it is an easy transit across the Arctic. We are still experiencing unstable conditions and uncharted ice in the Arctic. So to get from eastern to western markets isn't easy. Does this mark a record-breaking event? Absolutely. Can we expect to see this year on year? I'm not sure.
So how would it change the Arctic if, say, the northern route were passable all year long as opposed to just June through October? How would communities in the far north be affected?
There are 4 million people that call the Arctic home. And if we are experiencing shipping available throughout all 12 months, that means that Arctic warming is causing catastrophic impacts for communities across the north. They will experience displacement, permafrost, the ground upon which homes, schools, fuel tanks are built, will start to degrade and become unstable. In short, this is an indicator of grave human rights challenges for every resident across the North.
And geopolitically, what is the significance of the Northern Sea Route? Why is it important?
The Northern Sea Route hugs the Russian coastline. There are 3 potential sea routes in the Arctic. The Northern Sea Route is the only one that's currently viable. That means that Russia has the most to benefit from the short-term warming that we will experience. They can increase their oil and natural gas exploration, extraction, and export. And it means that they have a more powerful foothold in the Arctic compared to other countries economically.
So what is at stake for the Arctic and for the rest of us if climate change continues at this pace?
What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. It impacts us all. Just this past week, we have seen devastating extreme weather reach down from the Arctic through America's Midwest and into Texas. That's because the Arctic is at an unstable state. That extreme weather that is connected to the Arctic's climate system is impacting all of us, no matter where you live.
Victoria Herman heads the Arctic Institute. She's been speaking with us from Washington. Victoria, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
More stories from around the globe coming up. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Hi, it's Marco. Here at The World, we ended 2020 strong by raising over $100,000 to support the show and this podcast. Thanks to you and these listeners: Robert Brewer, Barbara Assady, Colette G. Blakey, Annie Armistead, Linora Williams, Arvind Kannan, Michael Sands, Angela Ozema, Robert Briggs, and Daniel Hadley. You guys rock my world. Thanks for your support throughout 2020 as we dive headfirst into 2021. The insurance giant Lloyd's of London is digging into its past, going through documents to learn about its role in the slave trade.
Being honest about their company's involvement with slavery, they are contributing to an opening up of a broader conversation.
Digging through Lloyd's archives to re-examine British history, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. You've heard it said many times, the globe is facing an unprecedented challenge, trying to immunize everyone on Earth. First, you need enough shots, then you need to get the vaccines where they need to go, and you got to get people to trust that the vaccine is safe. All week, we'll be exploring the challenges of outreach in hard-hit, historically marginalized communities. We're visiting Pakistan, France, the UK, and China. To get us started, let me turn to The World's Alana Gordon, who covers global health for the show. Alana, one of the main groups behind the global response is UNICEF, the UN's Child Emergency Fund. What exactly is UNICEF's role here?
So, Marco, UNICEF has for years led global efforts in vaccinating kids. And now they're one of the leads on COVID-19 vaccine efforts through the main global initiative COVAX that's focused on vaccine equity. And that's especially for low-income countries around the world.
Yeah, UNICEF has led the way on vaccine campaigns for kids for decades, right?
They have. And obviously, this effort now is for a much broader adult population. I spoke with Dr. Robin Nandy about this. He's chief of immunizations for UNICEF. He's excited about this massive effort.
The days are crazy these days, as you can imagine.
And he says UNICEF is wearing multiple hats. They are getting the vaccines to places, and then once there, they're working on outreach.
We need to ensure that the countries have the capacity to deliver the vaccines, so the workforce, logistics to deliver the vaccines. And on the other hand, the people that they're delivering vaccines to are ready to accept the vaccine.
Right. So how is UNICEF taking on that second part, dealing with the outreach?
So they've historically done a lot with this in engaging communities. It's also about clear communication about the COVID-19 vaccines. So they've developed manuals and toolkits. The level, though, of misinformation online now and in social media, that has meant whole new efforts in communities, specifically on the online stuff. But Nandy, Marco, also says that there's something bigger at play right now. It's about an overall trust in government.
The way that countries have dealt with the COVID-19 pandemic has led to a lot of distrust. Distrust in the system, distrust in the establishment, distrust in science in some cases. And this needs to be brought back.
And this is building on, Marco, 12 months where health systems have taken such a big hit. Nandy says what's really critical to a successful delivery of COVID-19 vaccines and those outreach efforts we're going to be hearing about is how communities trust and perceive their governments as being credible.
Yeah, and in that way, Alana, it strikes me that this vaccine campaign is about more than just jabs and arms to fight COVID-19.
Yeah, it's a lot more when you think about it. So if the effort goes well, this can mean actually a big boost for public health long term. But if it's a challenge and things go wrong, then on the other hand, this could have ripple effects well beyond just this one vaccine and virus. And in that way, Marco, the stakes couldn't be higher.
The World's Alana Gordon, thank you for this.
Thanks, Marco.
So let's look at how vaccine outreach has worked in the UK. The UK has had one of the world's highest death rates from COVID-19, not exactly a model for success. But there is one area where British Prime Minister Boris Johnson can claim some good marks, his country's vaccine rollout campaign. It's been one of the fastest on Earth. But a few months in, it's become clear that some communities are falling through the cracks. Here's The World's Orla Barry in London.
Politicians from opposing parties in Britain rarely see eye to eye. But black MPs from all parties do agree on one thing, encouraging people from Britain's black communities to get the coronavirus vaccine. They even made a video to get the word out.
We understand the fears, the anxieties and the confusion.
We understand the genuine history of mistrust some black people will rightfully feel.
Each of us. One of the lawmakers featured is London MP David Lammy. Lammy's uncle died from COVID-19 in New York last year.
That was very depressing and very real. And I was very, very sad not to be able to get to his funeral and frankly to have to watch that over Zoom.
But Lammy says his uncle is just one of the people he knows who's died from the virus.
I've lost an old school friend, classmate. Many people in the local mosques have lost their lives. You know, there's a lot of grief, I think, in black, Asian and minority ethnic communities here in the UK, where it's now become virtually impossible not to know someone really who has lost their life.
People from the black and Asian communities in the UK are almost twice as likely to die from the virus compared to white people. That's according to Public Health England, a government health agency. Now, a new study into the vaccine rollout in Britain finds that black, Asian and other ethnic minorities are less likely to have received the vaccine. Vaccine hesitancy appears to be one big reason for the discrepancy, which doesn't surprise David Lammy.
Because I had been in touch with relatives who are in their 80s and 70s to ask them if they had taken the vaccine. Many of them were coming back and saying no, they weren't sure they wanted it.
The causes of vaccine hesitancy are complex. There are plenty of examples of how badly Black people have been treated by the scientific community in the past. But Winston Morgan, a professor of toxicology and clinical biochemistry at the University of East London, says it's still a problem.
Most people will have a story of someone in their family or themselves engaging with the medical profession in some way and not having a nice experience, an experience based on discrimination or bias.
Just last month, a new report showed Black women in Britain are four times more likely to die in childbirth than white women. Poverty, poor housing and racism are said to be among the main causes. Morgan says the community needs to be represented among the scientists and healthcare leaders.
Fundamentally, Black people need to be part of the system as professionals, not just as customers or users. So they need to be part of the hierarchy. People need to see people who look like them in serious positions.
Dr. Anita Raja is acutely aware of this problem. She's a GP in Birmingham in England. Born to an Afghan mother and Pakistani father, Raja speaks Urdu, Punjabi and Persian. She released a video on social media recently explaining all about the vaccine in Urdu. Raja says ethnic communities need to be able to access information in their own languages and that trust with the medical profession is important too.
We've got a huge Bangladeshi Pakistani community here. And yes, I must say they are reluctant. They do not want to speak to their doctor because they feel that, you know, they might not be heard, they might not be understood.
Raja has noticed that she attracts Urdu and Punjabi speaking patients. And she's heard all the vaccine conspiracy theories. A new video featuring celebrities from ethnic minority communities was broadcast across Britain's TV channels a few days ago. It encourages people to get vaccinated and aims to debunk some of those myths.
The vaccine does not include pork or any material of fetal or animal origin.
There is no chip or tracker in the vaccine to keep watching where you go. Your mobile phone actually does a much better job of that.
The vaccine does not change or damage our DNA. Not taking the vaccine can damage us more.
Religious leaders are also playing a role. Imams have delivered sermons during Friday prayers to reassure worshippers about the vaccine. And pop-up vaccination centres have opened at mosques and Hindu temples. Emmanuel Adeseko, a pastor in Birmingham, met with the religious leaders of different faiths recently to see what they could do to encourage vaccine uptake. And for Adeseko, it's also personal. His father died from COVID-19 last year.
He was 65 years old when he passed. So, you know, and he was a healthy man as well. It was quite a shock, to be honest with you.
Adeseko says he's heard from a lot of people who are nervous about the vaccine, but he says it's important not to criticise them for their views.
I've had scenarios where some people have said to me, listen, I don't want to take the vaccine. I said, okay, that's fine. The door is open if you want to have a conversation, because we don't want to be burning bridges in a time where we need every single citizen to be able to work together.
And there's still work to be done. The largest hospital trust in England says Black Caribbean, Black African and Filipino staff are getting vaccinated at a much lower rate than other healthcare workers. And that's the sort of thing, experts say, that will need to change for Britain to truly get a handle on the pandemic. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Tomorrow, we continue our series looking at how the vaccination programs are going around the globe and how China decided who gets the vaccine first. In Ecuador, they're a step closer to choosing their next president. The Electoral Council there just announced the top two candidates are headed for a runoff. There is a third candidate, though, who is accusing fraud. It's a tough time for Ecuador. The elections come at a time when the current president is deeply unpopular and when COVID-19 is hitting the country hard. Michael Fox reports.
It was 2 weeks after the election, past 2:30 a.m. Sunday morning, when Ecuador's National Electoral Council finally confirmed the victory of the top two candidates. Andrés Arauz was the clear winner, with almost a third of total votes. He's a 36-year-old former head of the central bank and a close ally of two-term President Rafael Correa, one of the key figures of Latin America's so-called leftist pink tide. Arauz spoke with Democracy Now! Last week.
We have a large opportunity to unite the progressive forces of Ecuador.
His challenger in the runoff will be Guillermo Lasso, a 65-year-old conservative former CEO of one of the country's largest banks. He's also a longtime Correa adversary in his third run at the presidency. But this has not been an easy election in Ecuador. The third candidate missed second place by 0.4% and has been claiming fraud. His name is Yaku Perez, and he's from the indigenous Pachacutic Party.
Eso sí, queda en manos de CNE.
Everything is in the hands of the National Electoral Council, he told supporters at an event last week. They are the ones who are cheating us. A partial recount was held at his request and suspended last week by the country's Electoral Council. Perez is now leading a march of indigenous movements that's supposed to arrive in the capital, Quito, tomorrow. In this video posted on Twitter, they chant, "Yes for transparency, not fraud." Yaku Perez is from Ecuador's Azuay province, where he fought water privatization in the early 2000s, and he was jailed for his anti-mining activism under the Correa government. Perez is a complicated figure. Although he's been called a leftist for his environmental policies, on social media, he's also vocally supported coups against leftist governments in Bolivia and Brazil. He previously backed the conservative banker Lasso for the presidency in 2017. That's Guillermo Lasso, who beat him for second place in this election. Mark Becker is a professor of Latin American studies at Truman State University, who has spent decades researching Ecuador's indigenous movements and Yaku Perez's indigenous Pachacutic political party.
There are deep, deep divisions within Pachacutic. There's a left and a right wing. Yaku Perez represents the right wing.
Perez has presented little evidence detailing exactly what electoral fraud may have occurred, says MIT election researcher Jack Williams.
Fraud is incredibly difficult to do, so it would be likely that there would be some sort of accusation of to what the mechanism would be if fraud actually had occurred.
I reached out to Williams because in the days following the election, as votes were still being counted, Yaku Perez was actually in second place, though just barely. At the time, Jack Williams was tweeting that the right-wing banker Lasso would pull ahead because the ballots left to be counted were in more conservative areas. That is what happened.
It was already showing that there was going to be a really large margin for Lasso, especially in Quito and Guayaquil.
Regardless of the fraud claims, though, Yaku Perez's indigenous party made huge gains in the first round. Pachacutic had never before received close to 19%. Its representatives also picked up 22 seats in the National Assembly. It's now the second largest party after frontrunner Andrés Arauz's Centro Democrático, which will control 51 seats. Other left parties also made gains, a sign of the huge rejection for the current president, Lenin Moreno, whose approval rating is in the single digits. Decio Machado is a Spanish political analyst who has lived in Ecuador for more than a decade. He says the administrative capacity of the Lenin Moreno government has been horrendous. The country was already facing an economic crisis, which the pandemic has made even worse. Moreno faced huge protests in October 2019 after accepting loans from the IMF and imposing austerity policies. He fled the capital, Quito, and was forced to rescind the measures about 2 weeks later. Ecuadorians also blamed the president for failing to respond to the pandemic. The country has one of the highest COVID-19 death tolls per capita in the region. Enough of the pillage of our country, said one Ecuadorian in a video posted on Twitter. He was covered in snow at a polling station in Queens, New York, and had been waiting in line for hours to vote in the first round. He was one of 120,000 Ecuadorians registered to vote from within the United States. These thieves need to get out, he said. The question now is how the political forces will line up in the coming weeks. It's not clear which candidate Pachacutic and other voters will now support. In other words, there is a long way before Ecuador has a new president. For the World, I'm Michael Fox.
Edvard Munch's The Scream. It is one of the most recognizable paintings of our time. It's been discussed, studied, and gawked at for more than a century, especially during this pandemic. And even after all this time and all this talk, new details are being revealed. Here's the World's Bianca Hillier.
even if you've seen the scream in a museum, you probably haven't gotten close enough to see the sentence that's scrawled in the painting's top left-hand corner. Written in Norwegian, it translates to, "can only have been painted by a madman."
The inscription is very hard to read. The letters are quite tiny, and you have to know it's there to find it.
Maibritt Gulling is an Edvard Munch specialist and the curator of the National Museum of Art in Norway. She says people have known these words were on the painting for more than 100 years, but there's been debate over who wrote the inscription.
Some researchers have assumed it was by Munch himself, but it has been acknowledged as a general truth that it was not by Munch himself, but by a tactless visitor to the exhibition where it was on display.
Most people think a museum goer graffitied the famous painting back in the late 1800s. Gulling says nobody really bothered to look into the mystery more carefully, until the National Museum decided that the answer was an important part of history. They took infrared scans of the painting and started analyzing the handwriting.
Going through letters and notes known from Munch's archive, we can letter by letter and word by word compare, and it's obviously his own hand.
Gulling and her team say that's proof the late artist wrote this inscription himself. Experts also believe they now know when Munch added the note. They think it was written a few years after the painting was finished, following an exhibition in Oslo.
The critics were really harsh. They said that this showed that he was mentally ill. He was abnormal. He was degenerated. I think this was a direct reaction to this situation where he was being accused of being mad.
This baseless accusation hit home for Munch, as there was a history of mental illness in his family. Writing that the scream could only have been painted by a madman was a way for the artist to regain control of the narrative.
It shows how experimental Munch was and how little regard he paid to the rules of what an artwork should look like and how he should behave towards his art.
In time, Gulling says knowing who authored this message will reveal more about Munch himself. The scream has long been described as a portrait of the human soul, and it will be on display again next spring at the National Museum of Art in Oslo. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Lloyd's of London. Going back to the 17th century, it's been one of the world's oldest insurance companies. They are now looking for someone to comb through their archives, a collection of some 3,000 items that have possible ties to the transatlantic slave trade. Last June, Lloyd's apologized for its role in that trade and set out to better understand its connections to slavery. Katie Donington joins us. She's a lecturer of history at London South Bank University, where she focuses on British connections to slavery. Let's rewind a second, Katie, to understand this news a bit better. Why did Lloyd's feel the need to do this?
Well, Lloyd's of London has a history which is intimately connected with British Caribbean slavery. So it formed at a point in time where Britain was one of, if not the leading slave trading nation, and the marine insurance industry was developed in order to provide some security for investors who were investing in what was a very risky form of business, which was the trade in enslaved people, but also the trade in slave-produced commodities. And Lloyd's of London has responded to the Black Lives Matter protests that occurred during the summer of 2020 by tying up its history of involvement with the slave trade and slavery to issues of racial injustice in the present.
Yeah, help us understand a bit better, because you explained the British role in the transatlantic slave trade, but as an insurer, how does Lloyd's of London play into that?
The marine insurance industry could insure enslaved people, but only against the perils of the sea, so shipwreck, things like that. Enslaved insurrections were not generally covered. There was also the trade in slave-produced commodities, so things like sugar, cotton, coffee, pimento, wood, both of these different kinds of slavery-related commodity. And I hate to use that terminology, because when we talk about slavery, we are talking about the commodification of human beings and their transformation into objects. And you see that reflected in the language of insurance, in which, you know, human beings were discussed in terms of cargo.
It is a grim way to talk about it, but it does illustrate the dehumanizing aspect of slavery. Do you think this action by Lloyd's is a positive step? And if so, what other positive steps could they be taking on this?
The basis of any conversation about what the history of transatlantic slavery means to any nation has to be underpinned by evidence-based research. We need to talk precisely about who was involved and in what ways they were involved and to what degree they profited from the system. I think openness and honesty with regards to the history is an absolutely fundamental part of repairing the historical narrative, because for a very long time, Britain has not spoken or engaged with its history of profit and participation. It's been very, very forthcoming in terms of representing its history of abolitionism, but that much more complex, extended, and difficult history of profit and participation has to some degree been a much more uncomfortable conversation to have.
Well, there was this recent study from Historic England connecting a number of towns, churches, even pubs with the slave trade. So how is this all being received in the UK right now? How is British society coming to terms with this history?
It's quite a complicated reception. I would say that some of the more recent studies that have come out, including reports by Historic England, also by the National Trust, have emerged at a very particular political moment in which the reports are not necessarily being simply read as an accurate recounting of the historical archive and of historical fact. They're being presented, particularly in the right-wing press, through a highly kind of politicized lens of what's been described as the culture wars. So, you know, an attempt to really frame any engagement with histories of slavery and colonialism as a form of sort of doing Britain down or you know, an attack on British national identity. And I think that is a huge mistake, because this is simply part of the British past. It's part of our history, and it shouldn't be sugarcoated and it shouldn't be denied.
What do you think happens to the Lloyd's collection from here?
It's an interesting question. That, I mean, the job description for the archivist said that, you know, items from the collection would go on display in their properties in central London. So it seems to suggest that perhaps these objects will potentially form part of an exhibition. There is always the potential as well for the digitization of objects. So, you know, a really thorough website, which would allow access, of course, for, importantly, for people living in, for example, Africa and the Caribbean, to be able to see what some of the material legacies of slavery are in relation to Lloyd's. I think there's lots of potential for Lloyd's to do lots of different things with it, to engage the broader public with its histories. And I'm really interested to see what comes of that in the future.
Katie Donington is a lecturer of history at London South Bank University and focuses on British connections to slavery. She's been speaking with us about insurance giant Lloyd's of London searching for an archivist to comb through its documents related to the slave trade. Katie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Finally today, we've seen some stunning images from Mars, but we've never heard Mars like what it sounds like until perhaps this afternoon.
Touchdown confirmed. Perseverance safely on the surface of Mars.
NASA's rover Perseverance landed on the red planet late last week, loaded with all sorts of scientific goodies, including a small helicopter and 25 cameras. But we're radio heads here, so we're really excited about the rover's two microphones and the audio they captured from Mars. NASA rocket scientist Dave Grohl, no, not that Dave Grohl, he made the big reveal this afternoon. Drum roll.
So that gentle whirl that happens in the background, that is a noise made by the rover. But yes, what you did hear 10 seconds in was an actual wind gust on the surface of Mars, picked up by the microphone and sent back to us here on Earth.
A puff of Martian wind. I'll take it. All right, forget about sound, because Perseverance actually has a bigger job, as loath as this radio guy is to admit it. It touched down near an ancient river delta, where it will attempt to answer a very old question. Nina Lanza is a team lead for space and planetary exploration at Los Alamos National Laboratory.
Was there or is there life elsewhere in the solar system or even the universe? This is a really important, fundamental question that we'd like to answer, and Perseverance is going to be able to help us find that answer.
Lanza is also on the team that operates an instrument on the rover called the SuperCam.
It sits as the head of the rover right on top of the mast, and it has a cyclops eye that shoots a laser and vaporizes rocks, which is really cool, I think.
A cyclops eye, rock zapping lasers on Mars. I don't know, where can you really go from there? The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We're always online, day and night, at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again here tomorrow.